The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, North Carolina History for Students. We'll be reading today from Volume 59, Number 2, Find Your Voice, North Carolina Government, Politics, and You. It's the Spring 2020 edition. And the next article we'll be reading is Reporting on the North Carolina Legislature by Rob Christensen. Rob Christensen was a longtime political reporter for the News and Observer of Raleigh. He is also the author of the book The Rise and Fall of the Branch Head Boys, North Carolina's Scott Family and the Era of Political Politics, published by the UNC Press in 2019. At every country store that we stopped as we made our way across the eastern tobacco fields, Lieutenant Governor Jimmy Green would try to make me sweat. "See that reporter fellow?" Green, a crusty old tobacco warehouseman, would say, pointing me out to the farmers who gave me hard looks. "He's the one who's been giving me all that trouble back in Raleigh," he said. Green was the powerful leader of the state Senate, but in 1984 he was seeking the Democratic nomination for governor, despite having just survived a corruption trial, which meant I was on the campaign trail with him as the chief political reporter for the News and Observer in Raleigh. After each stop, we piled back into his car and went to the next country store, where Green would repeat his comments. Being scorned by politicians was nothing new to me. I had been denounced on the stump by two U.S. senators on the same day, been thrown out of the state Republican convention by resolution, been called Peeping Rob on the radio by one high-ranking state official, and accused by a congressional aide of killing a Raleigh political operative by writing a negative story about him. The Jimmy Green performance underscored the adversarial relationship between lawmakers and the news media, often called the Fourth Estate. In the words to no sidebar here, news media is defined as an umbrella term for all the sources that bring news and information to people. Print media, newspapers, magazines, broadcast news, TV and radio, and online, podcasts, blogs, web pages. Fourth Estate is defined as the news media of a country, not a formal part of the three branches of government, but often seen as a fourth power that has a strong influence on government and politics. And back to the article. While reporters are rarely liked figures in the legislative building, there is a symbiotic relationship between the news media and elected officials. Green needed the publicity. I needed the story. So despite the insults, we traveled all day together. The news media serves as an important watchdog on the legislature, monitoring legislative activity, sniffing out hidden provisions in bills, fact-checking what lawmakers say, keeping track of how special interests try to influence the making of laws, and keeping tabs on who is financing the lawmakers' election campaigns. Sort of like undertakers and tax auditors, reporters perform a necessary function, although not a particularly popular one. Few people like having someone looking over their shoulder, but the smart lawmakers also know that news reports are critical to getting their message out to their constituents. The shaky relationship with the news media is not the only inherent tension facing legislators. There is also stress between the different branches of government, especially when different political parties controlled the branches. When the state began electing Republican governors, the Democratic legislature moved to weaken the powers of the governor. The reverse was true when we have had Republican legislatures and Democratic governors. Even when the legislature and governor are members of the same party, there is often simmering competition about who's going to be the top dog in Raleigh. There is also tension between the legislative and judicial branches, particularly when judges rule that some of the laws or legislative redistricting maps passed by the legislature are unconstitutional. The checks on legislative power, whether from the news media, the governor, or the courts, are important because North Carolina has one of the most powerful legislatures in the country. North Carolina's founders designed it that way because of their suspicion and hostility toward royal governors under British rule. North Carolina was the last state to give its governor powers to veto legislation in 1996. And even then, it was one of the weaker vetoes in the country. Governors, for example, can't veto legislative redistricting plans or constitutional amendments, and they don't have line item vetoes. So powerful is the General Assembly that it is one of the few state legislatures in the country to have its own separate building. In fact, Tar Heel lawmakers have two buildings of their own. Governors are term limited to two terms, while there are no restrictions on how long a legislator can serve. For many years, North Carolina was one of the few states where governors could only serve one term. For most of North Carolina's history, the legislature was controlled by Democrats. Like much of the South, North Carolina was a largely one-party state, so people registered as Democrats regardless as to whether they were liberals, conservatives, or moderates. That began to change with the rise of two-party politics in the 1960s and 1970s. In 2010, the Republicans took control of both the state House and Senate for the first time in more than a century. They were elected in such large numbers that they had enough votes, two-thirds, to override any gubernatorial veto. This situation emboldened the GOP-controlled legislature to pass a passel of bills, moving North Carolina from having mainly moderate laws to having much more conservative laws. The political outcome could be seen on a wide range of issues, including taxes, government regulations, abortions, transgender rights, gun rights, voting rights, compensation for laid-off workers, and Medicaid health insurance for low-income residents. The conservative shift provoked a counterreaction as thousands of North Carolina residents descended on Raleigh to protest the changes in what would become known as the Moral Monday movement because the protests were held on Mondays. Led by progressive clergy, most of the protesters demonstrated outside, but over a period of months, more than 900 were arrested for civil disobedience in the legislative building. The movement culminated in a mass rally on February 8, 2014, which drew between 30 and 80,000 people, regarded as the largest civil rights protest in the South since the Selma to Montgomery March in 1965. The grassroots social movement spread to such other states as Georgia, Florida, Alabama, Missouri, Illinois, and New Mexico. Besides the conflict in the streets, the battle has been fought in state and federal courts, with legislative critics often suing the legislature for passing what they argue are unconstitutional laws. The legislative building on Jones Street has become a national symbol for the polarization of American politics. While the legislature has become an increasingly important battleground, it is being covered by fewer and fewer reporters. Newspapers are in sharp economic decline both nationally and in North Carolina, and many no longer have the money to send reporters to cover the legislature. Many TV and radio stations used to assign reporters to cover the legislature, but few do today. Who will watch the legislature in the future? Right now, nobody knows the answer to that question. Here are the captions of the photographs accompanying this article. Governor Terry Sanford addresses a joint session of the North Carolina General Assembly on June 8, 1961. Notice the gallery above where the public is allowed to sit. Can you spot reporters, camera crew, and photographers at work? Reporters cover a rally at the legislative building in 1981. The North Carolina legislative building sits on 5.5 acres, one block north of the state capitol. The building cost $5.5 million and first opened on February 6, 1963. The building is open to the public 7 days a week and is available for tours. This is how you get your news about politics and government in the early 1900s. The boys in this photo, taken on August 31, 1915, were newspaper carriers for the Raleigh Times. Notice their bare feet. The Raleigh Times building is a popular restaurant by the same name. The next article is From School Newspaper to Washington, D.C., and is written by Sally Bloom, who works at the North Carolina Museum of History, writing and producing online teacher workshops and other videos, and managing the Longleaf Film Festival. Local Girl Does Good could be the headline for Cindy Sain, a native North Carolinian. Sain is spelled S-A-I-N-E. Sain was editor of her high school newspaper, and today she puts those skills to work as a journalist covering the United States White House and State Department. Sain grew up in Matthews in Mecklenburg County and attended Independence High School in Charlotte. There, as editor of the school's newspaper, the Declaration of Independence, she advocated for the paper to cover topics beyond the football game scores and drama department plays, although she attended the first and performed in the other. Sain reported on national and international topics that made clear to students what was going on in the world affected their daily lives in North Carolina. At the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Sain majored in political science and Spanish and spent 1 year attending the Universidad de Sevilla in Spain. She is fluent in Spanish. Recognizing the perspectives from other countries help enhance people's understanding of international news, Sain tackled learning another language and earned the Goethe Institute's Große, which is big, German diploma in German language, culture, and literature from the Ludwig Maximilian Universität in Munich. In Germany, Sain reported for Deutsche Welle, Germany's public international broadcaster, where she reported on the German parliament, explaining German politics and important foreign policy developments to the world. Returning to the United States, Sain began reporting for the Voice of America, VOA. VOA was created in 1942 by the federal government to counter Nazi propaganda with unbiased news and information. Today it is the largest United States international broadcaster. The station provides news in more than 40 languages to an estimated weekly audience of more than 275 million people. At VOA, Sain began as an editor, then was a congressional correspondent for 7 years. She joined the White House Press Corps in April 2016 during President Barack Obama's administration. Today, Sain covers U.S. foreign policy and international affairs as VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent, covering both the White House and the State Department. At the 2016 White House Christmas party, then-President Barack Obama thanked her, saying, "VOA does great work. Keep it up." Sain has traveled widely as part of the White House and diplomatic press corps. One highlight for a political science nerd was the day she spent inside the Kremlin in Moscow for about 8 hours, while then-Secretary of State John Kerry met with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Sain says, "I love my job and feel humbled that so many people around the world care about foreign policy and international news and trust VOA." What does foreign policy reporting mean? Sometimes it means hurry up and wait for a State Department spokesperson to return a call, or for the Secretary of State to answer a question during a press briefing, or going out and interviewing senior officials, academic experts, and people on the street. It means writing accurate, balanced, and unbiased information quickly, recording it and taking photos in tight spaces and at large events, distilling what's important for listeners and viewers to know. Reporting also means knowing the history of world and local events and understanding the culture of the people in the story. It means travel, long days, and the opportunity to serve the public by sharing critical information and in-depth analysis. Reporting creates primary sources every day. The next article is Brother Exum Takes Her Seat, North Carolina's First Female Legislator, by Chelsea E. Wager, who is Outreach Coordinator at the North Carolina Museum of History. She works to make history come alive for students and educators through the museum's K-12 resources beyond the exhibits. I am by nature very conservative, but I am firm in my convictions. I want to blaze a trail for other women. I know that years from now there will be many other women in politics, but you have to start a thing. Lillian Exum Clement, The News and Observer of Raleigh, January 1921. Courageous, gutsy, pioneer. These are just a few words that can be used to describe Lillian Exum Clement and her accomplishments. After all, what else do you call a woman who ran for office before a woman could even vote? Clement was born near Norfolk in Watauga County, Norfolk, I believe, on March 12, 1886. She was one of six children born to George W. and Sarah Elizabeth Burnett Clement. During her early teens, her family moved to Asheville, where her father worked on construction of the Biltmore House. It was in Asheville where Clement received her schooling. She attended All Souls Parish and Asheville Business College, and by many accounts was a dedicated student. Her dedication landed her a position working as an office deputy in the Buncombe County Sheriff's Office, an unusual place for a woman at the time. But her determination didn't stop there. Though women were not allowed to attend law school, Clement set her sights on becoming a lawyer. She worked as an office deputy by day and learned the intricacies of the law by night, studying under teachers like James Jefferson Britt and Robert G. Goldstein. All her hard work and studying paid off on February 7, 1916, when she passed the state bar exam. Just the fourth woman to do so in North Carolina. Of the roughly 68 men who tested the same day as Clement, many of whom had graduated from colleges and universities where their studies had concentrated in law, she received one of the top scores. Clement opened her own practice in Asheville in 1917 and became the first woman in North Carolina to establish her own firm without any affiliation to a male lawyer. Over the next several years, she earned a reputation for her quick wit and skill. In 1920, Clement was called upon to accept the Democratic nomination to the General Assembly from Buncombe County. Chief Justice Walter Clark of the North Carolina Supreme Court wrote to Clement, supporting her nomination and encouraging her to run, writing, "I am gratified to note that your friends are thinking of nominating you for the legislature from your county. I should be glad to see North Carolina take this forward step in recognition of the service women have rendered this state, though a tardy recognition, too, and hope that you will not decline to honor." Brother Exum, as she became known, accepted the honor of the nomination 2 full months before the 19th Amendment was ratified. That's right. Lillian Exum Clement ran for a seat in the General Assembly of North Carolina before women could officially vote in the United States. Lillian ran against two male opponents in the primary, which she won. She went on to the general election in November of 1920 and won a landslide victory of 10,368 votes to 41. On January 5, 1921, Clement officially took her seat in the General Assembly, becoming the first woman in North Carolina and the South to hold legislative office. Though Clement only served one term in the General Assembly, her time governing was quite prolific. She introduced 17 bills, many of which passed. The legislation she introduced included reducing the amount of time of abandonment necessary before filing for divorce, funding for a training school to assist single mothers, and the use of secret ballots, among others. Lillian Exum Clement helped to pave the way for North Carolina women to serve their state by assuming public office. from former North Carolina Governor Beverly Perdue to North Carolina Supreme Court Chief Justice Sherry Beasley to the 44 women currently serving in our General Assembly. Clement's legacy lives on. Here are the captions to the photographs with this article. Lillian Exum Clement, now married to Eller Stafford, poses with their daughter Nancy around 1923. Lillian Exum Clement on the grounds of the state capitol 1921 in Raleigh. The General Assembly met inside the capitol during the period which Clement represented Buncombe County. A portrait of Lillian Exum Clement around the time she served as North Carolina's first woman legislature, 1921. And there's a sidebar article related to this. Did you know that votes weren't always secret? During the mid-1800s to early 1900s, North Carolina political parties printed their own ballots. When see-through ballot boxes were used, a ballot's color would be clearly visible. Anybody could see what a voter was choosing. And that meant that voters might experience pressure, bribery, or even threats to vote a certain way. Lillian Exum Clement introduced a bill to adopt the use of secret ballots to the North Carolina Assembly during her term, but it did not pass. Secret ballots in North Carolina were not required by law until 1929. The next article is Still Fighting. After gaining the right to vote in 1920, several former suffragists became delegates to the Democratic and Republican state and national conventions. A handful of women became mayors of small towns. But it was almost 75 years later in 1992 before a North Carolina woman was elected to a full term in the United States Congress. And 1996 before a woman was elected to a statewide office. Today, women still hold less than a quarter of North Carolina's 5,000 elected positions. So women are still fighting, and not just for equal representation in politics. They still sign petitions, write letters, lobby legislators, and join political organizations, the way the suffragists of the early 1900s did in North Carolina. But Tar Heel women are making their voices heard in marches, rallies, and protests, and have been on the front lines of recent protests here and in Washington, D.C. Women who were first. North Carolina's first female member of Congress was Eliza Jane Pratt, born in 1902, died in 1981. She was chosen in a special election to finish the term of her boss, U.S. Representative William J. Bergen, after he died in office in 1946. She held the position for less than a year and did not run for re-election. Elizabeth Liddy Dole, born 1936 of Salisbury, was elected North Carolina's first female United States Senator in 2002. In 1992, Eva Clayton, born in 1934, became the first woman to represent North Carolina in Congress. She was also North Carolina's first female African-American congressperson, and was North Carolina's first black United States House representative since 1901. Elaine F. Marshall, born 1945, is North Carolina's Secretary of State, and in 1996 became the first woman elected to this office and the first woman elected to statewide executive office in the state. More women elected. Sherry K. Berry, elected 2001 to the present, seen here on this 2016 campaign brochure, was elected North Carolina's first female commissioner of labor in 2000. Isabella Cannon made history when she was elected mayor of Raleigh in 1977, the first woman elected as a mayor of a large North Carolina city. She was known as the little old lady in tennis shoes because she was elected at the age of 73. The political flyer at right promotes Janet Cowell, elected 2009 to 2017, who was North Carolina's first female state treasurer in 2008. Women's March. Thousands of women and men and kids crowded the streets of the state capitol during the 2017 Women's March on Raleigh. Many carried homemade signs and banners to share their political beliefs. Welcome to the party. After passage of the 19th Amendment, several leading North Carolina suffragists quickly switched their activism from campaigning for their vote to campaigning for politicians in whichever political party they had joined. Women gained leadership positions in both the Democratic and Republican parties and fought to elect mainly male candidates, decades before women themselves began being elected to office in larger numbers. Civil rights protests. Civil rights protests like the one on Franklin Street in Raleigh took place across North Carolina and around the nation during the 1960s. Women were always on the front lines. Here are some stories from the collection. Did you know that objects tell stories? Your North Carolina Museum of History collects these artifacts, the things that people create, use, and leave behind to bring the state's history to life. Here are some of their stories. A pipe bowl from the late 1800s. Having your face on the end of a pipe might seem like a slightly odd tribute. But Zebulon Vance, in office from 1862 to 1865 and 1877 to 1879, was an extremely popular politician, and his image showed up in all kinds of places in North Carolina. He was the first elected governor during the Civil War while he was serving as a colonel in the Confederate Army. His second term came a little over a decade later. He then spent 15 years representing the state as a United States senator. A Let Women Vote poster in 1917. This poster is taken from a drawing on the cover of the October 27, 1917 issue of The Woman Citizen, a publication of the National American Woman Suffrage Association. The artist, James Montgomery Flagg, also created the iconic I Want You image of Uncle Sam used during World War I. And political campaign items. Candidates running for governor need to grab the attention of the voters. Campaign posters, yard signs, and bumper stickers all help candidates get their names and sometimes their faces on every corner at election time. Buttons and even a thimble from Dan K. Moore in 1964 are all quick ways to show support. But what about the tent? We don't really know much about it other than it was for Governor Greg Cherry's campaign in 1944 and says Cherry Headquarters on the back. And there are two buttons, one for Umstead for governor and one for Jim Hunt for governor. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading from the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast on our website, NCReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.